Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Listeners, every Thursday night during President Biden's first 100 days in office, I'm hosting a series of call-in specials called America, Are We Ready? And we've been having such good discussions with our guests and with callers from across the country that we want to share them with you on this podcast feed. So here's this past Thursday's America, Are We Ready? I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. This is a weekend special. This hour, how to move on from Donald Trump's relationship to the rest of the world. Did Trump get anything right in the ways he reset with China, with Mexico, with international treaties like on climate and Iran? Should President Biden revert to Obama-Biden policies, or is there a better, newer way? Good evening, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer, back with you for America, Are We Ready? And as I mentioned before the news, today began the first meetings between Biden's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor and their Chinese counterparts. Very interesting, after Trump was so focused on China. Transforming U.S. policy toward Latin America, including at the southern border, is already complicated, with illegal crossings near a two-decade high, according to the Biden administration itself. Another question, how much vaccine stockpile should we share with other countries? And there is so much more. We have two great guests this hour, beginning right now with Fareed Zakaria, Washington Post columnist and the World Affairs host on CNN. Many of you know his Sunday morning show called Fareed Zakaria GPS. He also has a book out called 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Fareed, always great to talk to you. Welcome to America, Are We Ready? And we're still getting Fareed's line hooked up. And Fareed, now we have you, right?
You do have me. I was unmuting myself. The next book I write about the pandemic will be called Can You Please Unmute Yourself?
That's a good title for a book when we can all look back and laugh maybe a little bit. Let's start with immigration. Biden's Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas admitted this week that illegal crossings are on pace for nearly a two-decade high. Nearly 180,000 people have arrived at the southern border since January, is the number you cite in your column last week in the Washington Post, which is headlined, Biden's generous immigration policies could turn out to backfire. So what's he doing that you characterize as generous, and what would a backfire look like?
Well, it's already backfiring, but let me begin by saying that Joe Biden is doing a much better job on immigration than Donald Trump. The Trump administration have put in place almost 1,000 different rules, regulations, new fees that are all designed to make it much harder for immigrants, would-be immigrants, students, even tourists, visit the United States, to extend their stay, to stay for longer, to work for anything at every stage. It has been the most successful part of Trump's generally unsuccessful public policy. They really were focused on this. Biden has started to overturn lots of it. However, the one area where I think he has made a mistake is on asylum policy at the southern border. The Trump administration ended up, after the kids in cages and separating them from their parents, they ended up finding some way to deal with the crisis, which has been occurring now for almost 5 or 6 years. And the Biden people overturned that as well. What's the crisis? The crisis is that you're having lots more people than ever before arrive at the southern border asking for asylum. Now, asylum rules are different from regular immigrants, and that requires that they be looked at carefully. But the truth of the matter is, 99% of the people coming to the southern border and asking for asylum are really just traditional immigrants.
Really? What I hear from the immigration advocates is that there is such a crisis, mostly in several Central American countries, that's what's driving it. And to the extent that it's unaccompanied minors, which is so much of what we hear about in the media, who would send their kids to go to another country by themselves unless it's really an asylum-worthy crisis?
So what they are fleeing is essentially poverty and violence, often gang violence. But that's what everybody flees when they come to America. The asylum system was set up after World War II, really, you know, in light of what happened to Jews in Germany in the 1930s. That is the systematic, singular persecution of groups of people because of their ethnicity, religion, or political views. It has been used very sparingly throughout. You can tell why I'm right about this, Brian. The vast majority of applications get turned down because they are actually not applications. And on the unaccompanied minors, consider this. The number of unaccompanied minors has gone up, I don't know, fivefold ever since Joe Biden changed the Trump rule. The Trump rule did not make a special exception for unaccompanied minors. Biden does. So I hate to put it this way, but people are gaming the system. And what they are trying to do is to essentially go ahead or in a different line than regular immigrants. And because they come at the southern border and they produce a crisis, we now have, as the secretary said, not just that it's a 20-year high, but you have 10 times as many people who are coming and claiming asylum as there were 20 years ago. All right. Conditions in Central America 10 times worse than they were 20 years ago?
Provocative position. Let's take our first caller, Sadish, originally from India. You're on America. Are we ready? Hello, Sadish. Oh, he hung up. All right. Well, since we went that way first, let's try another caller originally from India. Sanjay, you're on America. Are we ready? Do we have you?
Hi, yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Thanks a lot for calling in. So give us one piece of U.S. foreign policy you would like to see Biden implement toward India.
Well, it's like a really delicate situation considering India is one of our strongest allies in that region, especially considering we have a mutual, a common enemy, so to speak, in China. But as someone from Chennai, who in Tamil Nadu, that is a state that's not as ardent of a supporter of the BJP, you know, I've been seeing and like reading about all of these racially charged attacks against Muslim people in India, and maybe so much less policy than a public denouncement of the way that the BJP has been either allowing or straight up advocating for these hate killings against
Hindu
Muslims.
Nationalist violence against Muslims. Sanjay, I'm going to leave it there so we have time for a response. And Fareed, India is your country of origin too, isn't it?
It is indeed. And Sanjay points out a very interesting and important and difficult dilemma for the Biden administration. It is courting India as part of the kind of a coalition of countries to contain or deter China. India is actually not a very stalwart ally so far. It actually has not agreed to do joint military maneuvers with the U.S. It still buys a lot of military equipment from Russia. But the hope is that they're moving in that direction. The problem is, as Sanjay points out, while the U.S. is trying to create a kind of alliance of democracies to combat Chinese authoritarianism, India has been moving in the wrong direction. And this is not my opinion. There are two very respected international think tanks, Freedom House and Japan and Sweden's VDEM Institute, have both downgraded India to not a democracy on their lists of democracy. And these are very data-oriented, very factually based analyses. And in both cases, in one case, they call India an electoral autocracy. And in one case, Freedom House has downgraded India to partly free as opposed to free. So it's very worrying. India's
Let me ask you as a quick follow-up. Did Trump, who did have alliances with authoritarian leaders when it would seem to benefit him, enable India to any degree to sink to that status of not a full democracy? Is any of it on Trump as far as you're concerned, and in a way that Biden could reverse and have an impact?
I don't think so. I think that would exaggerate America's influence. India is a vast country, very internally obsessed. It's certainly true that the fact that the United States for 4 years has been utterly unconcerned about democracy and human rights created a general atmosphere in which people like Modi of India, Erdogan of Turkey, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Duterte in the Philippines were able to erode certain rights with a greater impunity. But I think the direction that India was heading in is probably largely, it's a very deep internal struggle. And as you said, Hindu nationalism has been a powerful force in India now for a couple of decades.
We're going to take a 1 minute break, and then we'll continue with tonight's edition of America, Are We Ready? Tonight, it's America, Are We Ready for the Rest of the World? In this series of Thursday night national call-ins for Joe Biden's first 100 days as president. We'll continue with Fareed Zakaria and more of your calls. We'll get into that meeting that began today between Biden officials and officials from China. How big a reversal? Maybe it's not as big as people are expecting from Trump on China. Are we seeing from Joe Biden? Stay with us. It's America, Are We Ready? Our Thursday night national call-in show for Biden's first 100 days. I'm Brian Lehrer with CNN's global affairs host and Washington Post columnist Fareed Zakaria for another few minutes. Then Susan Glasser from The New Yorker will join us as we keep taking your calls and keep talking about how Biden is trying to move on from Trump's America First stance toward the rest of the world. And we're taking your calls if you're an immigrant from anywhere or are listening now in any other country on one piece of U.S. foreign policy your country of origin might like from the Biden administration, or the same for the country where you are right now if you're calling from abroad. 844-745-TALK and Anam, originally from Palestine. You're on America, Are We Ready? Hello, Anam.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. So I wanted to talk about the Palestine-Israel conflict, and that's been going on for a while now. And in light of the recent pandemic, the heavy restrictions on Palestinians receiving the vaccine. So I'd like to see Biden... I know that Israel is an ally, but I'd like to see Biden kind of shift his policy towards relief efforts in Palestine and to, basically on a humanitarian basis, assist in efforts to have Palestine realize itself as a sovereign state, just in light of this pandemic and this crisis that's been going on. For the past year, we've seen how it's affected Palestinians on every level, including not having access to the vaccine.
Anam, thank you very much for your call. And Fareed Zakaria, there are always competing versions when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. I think the Israelis would say they haven't denied Palestinians the vaccine, that public health is a Palestinian Authority responsibility, and they will go back and forth, the two sides, on things like that. But how do you see the Biden stance toward the Israeli-Palestinian situation compared to Trump?
We don't know yet, Brian. It's a very good question. So far, they haven't made any big moves in either direction. Biden has always been a very strong supporter of Israel. The unfortunate reality for Palestinians is this, that the main axis in the Middle East over the last 10 or 15 years has shifted from being one about Israel versus the Palestinians, and instead it has become one about Saudi Arabia versus Iran, or the Sunnis versus the Shia. And in that new dynamic, which is really the dynamic that has been galvanizing Middle East for the last, certainly since the Iraq War, Israel and the Gulf Arab states that have traditionally tended to finance the Palestinian cause, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and countries like that, Israel and those Gulf Arab states are on the same side. They're both anti-Iran, in some sense anti-Shia. And so what has happened, what the Trump administration took advantage of, was this new reality. And that is why you have had the normalization of relations with the United Arab Emirates and Israel, with Bahrain and Israel. And so in a sense, the pressure is off Israel to do something on the Palestinian issue, because they're getting, you know, these Arab countries to normalize relations with them without having to make any movement on the Palestinian issue.
Can Biden put that pressure back on, and is he interested in doing that?
I don't think so. I think that ultimately the reality is that Arabs are moving in the direction of their self-interest, and there remains this big, somewhat insoluble problem with Palestine, with the Palestinian issue, which is that you have a divided Palestinian community and leadership, Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank. And my guess is Biden will say, this is not worth the diplomatic effort that it would take. I'm not going to get much success. As I say, it's a kind of tragedy for Palestinians mm-hmm. in the region, but that's how I see it.
Let's go next to Amy, originally from Taiwan. Amy, you're on America. Are We Ready? Thanks so much for calling in.
Yes. Hi, Brian. My concern is that I'd like to tell the American government to stop selling those overpriced, outdated weapons to the Chinese government. And I'd like to see the Biden administration start putting together some kind of peace talk between Taiwan and mainland China to promote or to encourage a peace agreement and sign a peace agreement, so we stop this increasing of sales of outdated, overpriced weapons to the Chinese government. Looks like, it's provoking a war.
Amy, thank you very okay. much for that. And let me use that as a jumping off point, Fareed, to talk about the high-level talks that began with China's two top foreign policy officials today in Alaska, and Biden's top two, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Here's what Blinken said about China in a major foreign policy address on March 3rd.
China is the only country with the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to seriously challenge the stable and open international system, all the rules, values, and relationships that make the world work the way we want it to, because it ultimately serves the interests and reflects the values of the American people. Our relationship with China will be competitive when it should be, collaborative when it can be, and adversarial when it must be.
So, Fareed, can you translate that from diplomatese into English?
I think that you hinted at it in one of your teases, Brian, which is you asked, is this an area where the Biden administration has changed much of the Trump administration's policies? And I think the honest answer would be no. I think that this is an area where you see much greater continuity between Trump and Biden than I would have expected, honestly. I think that they're approaching it somewhat differently. They are trying to gather the allies together, and actually, you know, these meetings with the Chinese have come after there were meetings with America's closest allies in Asia, South Korea and Japan. They are clearly leaving open the door for greater cooperation. But to be fair, so did Trump in the first years of his administration. I think it reflects the reality that politically in America, there is no real constituency for a warmer, more cooperative relationship with China. That while Trump was a big China hawk, actually became one after COVID, so is Bernie Sanders. So is Nancy Pelosi. So is Chuck Schumer. And I do actually worry that when you have a situation like that, where politicians, where diplomats and statesmen feel, you know, kind of boxed in, that there's no political incentive to, for example, cooperate with China on climate change or cooperate with China on trade, that you end up with a slightly uncreative policy where everyone has jumped on the anti-China bandwagon, which, by the way, has a small impact on the atmosphere within the United States, you know, toward Chinese Americans. So it is something I worry about. But for now, I think you'd have to say one is struck on this issue by the continuity with the Trump administration rather than the reversal of policy.
Fareed, before you go and we switch guests, and listeners will keep taking your calls, you wrote a Washington Post column in January when the administration was only a week old called "The Pandemic Will Not End Unless Every Country Gets the Vaccine." Now there's a debate about whether the U.S. should be stockpiling AstraZeneca shots for possible use when they're approved here, or if there's a moral responsibility to share those with countries that are already allowed to use them now, including ones not as economically privileged as us. Do you have a position on that and whether it relates to what kind of superpower the U.S. should aspire to be?
Let's start with the reality and give the Biden administration the credit it deserves. The United States has utterly transformed its situation with regard to vaccines. When Joe Biden came into office, we were vaccinating about 700,000 people a day, I think. There was a day last week where we vaccinated 4.5 million people. We vaccinated in one day more people than have been vaccinated in Italy in the entirety of this pandemic. So the U.S. is miles ahead of every major country other than the United Kingdom. It is probably stockpiled already 200 million vaccines more than it needs. So we are absolutely in the position where we can start to think about being generous towards our neighbors, towards the poorest in the world. And it is the kind of enlightened self-interest for which the United States has always been best known for. It is something we should do because we are the richest country in the world, but it's also something we should do because the only way you get rid of a pandemic is if everybody in the world is vaccinated. Otherwise, we will sit here worried about new variants, worried about restrictions on travel and trade, never really be able to get back to life as normal. And by the way, most of these investments have already been made. We have already paid large amounts of money for these vaccines, for the supplies. So it's not even as though it would take a huge amount of additional money. It would just be a question of recognizing at some point that we have more than enough for ourselves, that there's enormous need in some of the poorest countries in the world. I actually am confident that this is the direction the Biden administration will go in. Biden is very much somebody who comes out of that worldview that says the United States leads not just by its military power, but by its acts of generosity, its provision of, if you will, public goods for the world. And I think that he will want to go down as the person who showed that generous face of America to the world, not simply the clenched fist.
Interesting. And we should acknowledge that they did take a first step toward down that road just today, announcing that the U.S. will release 4 million doses total of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Mexico and Canada combined. Fareed Zakaria, Washington Post columnist, host of Fareed Zakaria GPS on CNN, and author of the book 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Thanks a lot, Fareed.
As always, Brian, a pleasure.
This is America, Are We Ready?, our Thursday night call-in series for Biden's first 100 days. And with us now, Susan Glasser, who writes the Letter from Biden's Washington column for The New Yorker. It was previously called Letter from Trump's Washington. And she's got major foreign policy chops of her own, having been editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, co-bureau chief, and co-author of the books Kremlin Rising and her current one, The Man Who Ran Washington, about former Secretary of State James Baker. Thanks for coming on, Susan. Welcome to America, Are We Ready?
Great to be with you, Brian.
And listeners, our caller question stands. Immigrants from anywhere, tell your fellow listeners one thing you would like from U.S. policy toward your country of origin. 844-745-TALK. Susan, let me introduce you to our listeners by taking advantage of your knowledge of Russia. The government announced this week, the U.S. government, that Russia and Iran were both trying to influence the 2020 presidential election, Russia on behalf of Trump again, Iran on behalf of Biden, apparently, and that China mostly sat it out. What's the best intelligence you've seen on how much mischief Russia caused this time and whether any Trump people enabled them?
Well, I think the thing that is striking is actually your last point, Brian, that this convergence in a way between the Trump support that Russia was offering and amplifying in this election cycle and the fact that they were connected to, according to this declassified U.S. intelligence report, connected openly to Trump supporters here in the United States. They don't name them, but it appears Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is one of those they're referring to. And then also just the coordination in a way and the convergence of the two messages. You have questions being sown about the integrity of the U.S. election, both by the Russians and by the president's own supporters, the former president's own supporters. And so, you know, this is really, I think, the next step in the evolution from Russia's support of Donald Trump in 2016. By 2020, there's this sort of almost established feedback loop in which, you have this Russian disinformation that then becomes the subject of propagandistic documentary on a pro-Trump American television channel.
Let's take our next caller. It's Calixte, originally from Haiti. Calixte, you're on America, Are We Ready? Thanks so much for calling in.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Can hear just fine. What would you like the Biden administration to do with respect to Haiti?
Yes, absolutely. The Biden administration needs to focus on, I think you just touched on it a little bit a while ago when you said what type of superpower America wants to be in this world. And Haiti is a country that's been taken advantage of by all Western superpowers, more specifically the United States. Bill Clinton has came out and said his policies has crippled the country with certain policies and trade that he had in place. But the biggest thing that Biden could do is bring France to the table and have France actually pay Haiti the reparations that they made Haiti pay to France when Haiti fought
Haiti
for their
was a French colony once upon a time.
Correct. And this in 1804, and that amount of money has really crippled the country. That amount of money that left a young country like that in 1804 really crippled the country. And to this day, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
And Calixte, I'm going to leave it there for time. We really appreciate you calling in. And Susan, we always do hear that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and the U.S. has had a tortured relationship with it. I don't know if you have your eye on U.S.-Haiti relations at all. Did Trump at all? And is there a Biden stance at all in a minute before we go to a break?
Well, unfortunately, Donald Trump had the view, and had a famous meeting in the Oval Office with some senators in which he referred to Haiti, I believe, among others, as, sort of
the S-hole countries.
Very
that included Haiti as well as countries in Africa.
It did. And, you know, again, Donald Trump was not interested in the problems of Haiti. And I do think in general, even for a different kind of administration like Biden's, this is a pretty inward-looking moment for the United States of America. We've had, you know, domestic political crises combined with the pandemic, combined with economic upheaval. And I think that, you know, between the demands of focusing on great power competition with China and Russia, as we've talked about, and this sort of sclerotic internal domestic
leaves
political
not
moment.
Much attention, right? We'll continue in a minute with Susan and your calls. America, are we ready? It's America, Are We Ready? Our Thursday night national call-in show for Biden's first 100 days. I'm Brian Lehrer with Susan Glasser from The New Yorker, and we're taking your calls. If you're an immigrant from anywhere or are listening now in any other country on one piece of U.S. foreign policy your country of origin might like from the Biden administration, or the same for the country where you are right now, if you're calling from abroad, 844-745-TALK. Before we take our next caller, Susan, let me play a short clip of President Biden from last month when he addressed America's European allies in a virtual international conference.
I know the past few years have strained and tested our transatlantic relationship, but the United States is determined to re-engage with Europe, to consult with you, to earn back our position of trusted leadership.
And so, Susan, can you put some meat on those bones in terms of any specific policies that Biden has enacted in his first 58 days that ties us back to Europe in ways that Trump untied us?
You know, that is where it gets harder, right? It's a lot easier to have a reassurance tour and to go around the world sort of reaping the benefits, if you will, of Donald Trump's unpopularity. And Joe Biden has done that. His envoys have done that. They've been very, I think, adept at playing off the world's almost palpable sense of relief in most places that Donald Trump is gone and replaced by someone who's much, much more solicitous of America's traditional allies and relationships. However, you know, it's early days, and on foreign policy, actually what we're seeing this week in some ways are the most concrete steps so far, where what you're seeing, frankly, is a willingness to consult with and to coordinate with allies before turning to adversaries like China and Russia. And that's why you had the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. They're meeting in China right now in Alaska. Even as we have this conversation with the Chinese, they really made a point of going to meet with the Japanese and the South Koreans, two historical American allies in Asia that were really at times very troubled in their dealings with Trump, who often preferred to, you know, pursue his great relationship with Xi Jinping, as he called it, or his love affair with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, as he called it. So I think that's where you see the biggest difference, is in the bringing allies in on the front end.
One follow-up regarding Europe. On the Paris Climate Agreement, which Trump took us out of and Biden, of course, put us back in, did Trump have a point to any degree, in your opinion, when he argued that one of the reasons Europe was for that treaty is that it tied the U.S.'s hands economically more than theirs, because we're the world's biggest per capita greenhouse gas polluter? I think that's an accurate stat. So Europe would gain some competitive advantage over the U.S. economically?
Well, look, I'm not a climate economist. I think in terms of the foreign policy aspects of it, what the Biden administration would say, like the Obama administration before it, is, first of all, this was something that America had its hand in negotiating on the front end. Also, its countries are responsible for meeting their own targets, right? So it's not that you're handing power to some other country. That's different than some of the climate goals and how they were structured in the past. You know, I think the real issue is also what's going to happen going forward. Many of those were targets that were designed to be potentially meetable. So I think, you know, again, Trump was a master of sort of disinformation and misinformation when it came to the Paris Climate Accord. As with so many other things, he and his administration would say, well, you know, we're here to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not the citizens of Paris. But actually, you're not representing the citizens of a foreign country. These are climate goals that apply only to the U.S., that the U.S. is buying into. So it'll be interesting to see what the next round of climate diplomacy is. Everyone agrees that there's a crisis. John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, has been tasked by Biden to become his climate envoy. He is a deal maker, as you know. He's eagerly looking. Is this somewhere where we could actually cooperate with the Chinese and the Russians at a time of tension in the rest of our relationship? I think that's going to be a sort of internal conflict, frankly, in the new Biden administration, as they figure out Kerry's desire to make deals versus the tensions that other foreign policy actors are gonna emphasize.
Yeah, and I'll note that you cited that famous Trump line that he was elected by the people of Pittsburgh, not the people of Paris, when in fact the people of Pittsburgh voted in the majority for Hillary Clinton. But Alexei, originally from Russia, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hello, Alexei.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Indeed, I am originally from Russia, and I wanted to suggest and ask Susan and yourself whether an acknowledgement of the recent sanction regime is effectively useless, toothless, symbolic in nature, and is based on moral principles, admirable as they are, but has failed to achieve any practical objectives, and whether in the spirit of realpolitik, perhaps an abandonment of these sanctions, or at least a more practical posture towards Russia, is in the cards. I think in terms of solving some of the world problems that would be more beneficial to America's interests than what we're seeing today.
Alexei, thank you very much. And in terms of what we're seeing actually today, Susan, I'm sure you saw this. Biden called Putin a killer, and Putin recalled his ambassador to the U.S.
Well, that's right. We're not going in the direction of reconciliation. And in fact, you know, Alexei's point about rounds of sanctions and whether they've had any effect on Russia, today is actually the 7th anniversary today of Russia's illegal annexation of the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine, which triggered, you know, back in 2014, the current round of various cycles of sanctions, which the U.S. and its European partners have placed on Russia for that illegal annexation of territory, which is the first such since the end of World War II. And, you know, so not only do I not see those sanctions going away anytime soon, but what we've seen from the new Biden administration so far is not only a tougher line, like President Biden's response when he was asked about Putin and he said, yeah, I think he's a killer. But it's not just rhetoric. You're also seeing the Biden team say that they're going to put more rounds of sanctions in place. In fact, they just last week announced one set of sanctions to respond to the poisoning and detention of Alexei Navalny, who is Russia's leading dissident. As you know, he was apparently poisoned by an illegal chemical agent Novichok and nearly died, was saved when he was allowed to go to Germany. He chose to fly back to Russia. Russia's response was to imprison him in a prison camp. So the U.S. has just set another round of sanctions in place. There are more responses, we're told, by the Biden team that are forthcoming in response to the massive Russian hacking, the SolarWinds hacking that took place last year that Donald Trump did not really respond to or seem to want to take seriously in a public setting. And so we don't know what the nature of that response is, but we're not headed in the direction, I would say, of a more conciliatory policy, to say the least, right now.
Mike in Atlanta, originally from Ethiopia. Hi, Mike. You're on America, Are We Ready?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Tell your fellow listeners around the country what one piece of foreign policy from Biden you or the nation of Ethiopia might like to see.
One thing I want to the Biden administration follow is I want them to get the information from the ground, from the exact place. I want the government not to take any information from a paid journalist and lobbyist. That makes a big difference for our country. because the fact on the ground is quite different from the information they are getting from the paid journalist. And
you're referring to something specific, and I'll admit that I don't know what it is, and probably a lot of our listeners don't know what it is. Who gave them what piece of what you're saying is false information?
Recently on CNN, they were reporting that the Ethiopian troops did some atrocity in the Tigray region. But the fact on the ground is that's not the case. What happened is the TPLF government, when they lost the war, they just freed 10,000 prisoners and put on the federal troops uniform and Eritrean troops uniform. And everybody thinks that the federal troops did all those atrocities. But the fact on the ground, no. The Tigrayan prisoners did all those bad things, if that things happened based on their reporting. And that's
Mike, thank you very much for that call. Susan, I don't know if you're focused enough on U.S. policy toward Ethiopia or what's happening over there, as Mike describes it, or as other people describe it, to have a take on what U.S. interest might be with respect to Ethiopia or U.S. responsibility.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, this is definitely not something I'm an expert on, but just today, actually, President Biden announced that he was sending basically one of his closest allies on Capitol Hill, Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, to Ethiopia. And I'm just looking online here, according to National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, to convey President Biden's grave concerns about the humanitarian crisis and human rights abuses in the Tigray region of Ethiopia and the broader risk of instability in the Horn of Africa. This is a really unusual move, and I think it suggests how seriously Biden and his team are taking these reports. It seems like the caller is essentially, you know, disagreeing that there is any human rights abuses or crisis unfolding right now in that region. So I think it is significant that Biden would choose to send Chris Coons, who is a foreign policy specialist, senior member of the Foreign Relations Committee, in addition to being basically like Biden's essentially like kind of personal envoy on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, very close to Biden from Biden's home state of Delaware, as you say. Leo in Cincinnati, originally from Venezuela. You're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Leo.
Hi, thank you for having me.
One piece of Biden policy toward Venezuela. We know Trump had no love for the Venezuelan government, which has no love for the United States. Were you pro-Trump in this respect, and what would you like to see from Biden?
Well, I would like to see nothing more than a strongest, let's say, sanctions, U.S. sanctions against the regime. The regime is a regime that is connected with narcos, is connected with all rogue countries that has been traditionally against the American life. And right now, the regime, the Maduro regime, is giving all those resources that our country used to still have, oil, uranium, gold, all those resources are landing in hands of those rogue regimes. Talking about North Korea, Turkey, Iran, Russia, Cuba, all of them are taking advantage of the how unstable is my country, and I'm trying to get this unstable the whole region. So for Biden, I would like to see a strongest, even more strongest approach with the Maduro regime. Until the moment that need to be turned down, I will tell you this. This should be the dream of every Venezuelan, get back a country that used to be the one trustful partner, all supplier for America. Right now is in this position, sadly, in a position that the people is suffering a lot, and the regime is only connected with the rogue countries.
Leo, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it. And Susan Glasser, we've been hearing in what I think has been an amazing call in this hour with people from literally from around the world, originally, now all living in the United States as immigrants, with things that they think it's important for the United States to do for the sake of people in the countries that they left. We have a few minutes left in the program, and I'm curious if you can take a step back and say, as a former editor-in-chief of a magazine called Foreign Policy, What is U.S. foreign policy for, in general terms, as the U.S. has seen it historically, and as other countries, like any of the ones that we just heard from immigrants from, would like it to be?
You know, Brian, I think it's a great moment to step back in the sense that, you know, the crises of the last few years, it's been an inward-looking time in the United States. And, of course, Donald Trump played off of that with his America First rhetoric. And, you know, the pandemic of the last year, we've literally been sort of sequestered at home contemplating our own election and the troubles here. And in a way, it's really, I think, caused me and other people to wonder, well, what does it mean? What does American leadership in the world mean anymore? Joe Biden spoke from the very beginning of his presidential campaign about American leadership and the idea, hey, world, just hold on, we'll be back. He's now proclaimed that he's leading a policy of being back. But the truth is, it's not clear there's the stomach for the kind of American leadership that we saw in the immediate post-Cold War era. That moment of sort of being the unilateral global superpower and guarantor, lone guarantor of the world order, has sort of frayed against the demands of American renewal that are clearly urgently needed.
But let me jump in with a follow-up question. And in our last minute and a half or so, your book, The Man Who Ran Washington, is about James Baker, who, among other things, was Secretary of State under the first President Bush. I don't have to tell you. At that moment when the Soviet Union collapsed, and then the first Gulf War came about. Biden was in the Senate then. Is there a key lesson you think Biden and his foreign policy team can learn from the James Baker story about what to do? Or, after Baker helped entangle us with Iraq, would it be more of a big lesson about what to avoid?
You know, Brian, I do think that Joe Biden, like Jim Baker, is in some ways a man of a different generation, when American leadership still seemed almost like the default setting. And I do think that's Joe Biden's default setting as a foreign policy thinker. I think he certainly cares more about American values and human rights than some more realpolitik politicians in both the Democratic and the Republican Party. But yeah, I think he is a previous era's view of America as the sort of shining city on the hill, the lone superpower. And I think that American possibilities and capabilities and the stomach that the American people have for engaging with the world, it's just very different than it was 20 years ago, never mind at the end of the Cold War, when Jim Baker suddenly found, you know, with the Soviet collapse, that America was all alone as the world's guarantor.
Susan Glasser, who writes the letter from Biden's Washington column for The New Yorker and is co-author of The Man Who Ran Washington, about former Secretary of State, among other things, James Baker. Thanks for coming on, Susan. We really appreciate
it. Brian, thank you.
And thanks again to Fareed Zakaria, who was on earlier. And listeners, thanks for your calls and thanks for your ears. And that's this week's edition of America, Are We Ready?, our Thursday night call-in show for Biden's first 100 days. You know, next Thursday night, we should have a very interesting show, because next Thursday during the day, President Biden will hold his first news conference. We will invite your reviews. If you're interested, you can subscribe to my national politics podcast called Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, or I'll see you back here next Thursday night for America, Are We Ready? Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is excerpted from my live radio shows on WNYC Radio. The live show is 10 a.m. to noon every weekday, and we're doing these national call-in specials that you just heard, America, Are We Ready?, every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern during Biden's first 100 days. Check your local NPR station to see if they're carrying the program, and if they're not, give them a call and say, hey, why aren't you carrying America, Are We Ready? From WNYC. Or you can listen online at WNYC.org. America, Are We Ready? Every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern. And thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.